Oh, man. R-U-T. All right, here we go. Jacob, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Doing well. Another individual got his topic in. All good choices. Good choices. Now keep in mind, just because you sent me a topic doesn't mean you got to stick with it. So if there's something that you stumble upon that you've maybe more to you, that's fine. Just let me know. That's all I ask. Just let me know. All right, so we spent the first couple of classes dealing with the state of the world. And obviously, the state of the world was complicated, yeah?
Yeah.
Every single major power was on one side or another of an alliance. Now, had Bismarck's system prevailed, this would have never happened. But Russia was jettisoned, allowed France to jump in bed with the Russians. Eventually, they pulled the British in. And the Japanese. And of course, they tussled with Germany and got the Kaiser looking like a bumbling idiot. Not once, but twice. While at the same time, the Russians were poking the Austrians, were poking the Serbians. It was bad. Bad, bad, bad. But even then, World War I was not guaranteed. And that's one of the amazing things. You learned that when the Archduke was dead, war was inevitable. That was not the case. It was not the case. But rather, what it did was present an opportunity to deal with some of the ongoing situations. And both sides looked at it in that fashion, which is shocking. So, for the Austrians, I mean, the truth of the matter is the Archduke, being the younger brother of Franz Joseph didn't really like his younger brother. Franz Joseph was sad because his son had committed suicide. He would have rather had his son as an heir. And so the fact that a brother died, no big deal. He had another younger brother. It wasn't the end of the world. And by the way, it wasn't like it was the first monarch to be killed. Monarchs, nobles were getting killed left and right. But this would give the Austrians a chance to flex their muscles, to smack the Serbians yet again. But it also was a possible opportunity for them to move forward with the conquest of the Balkans. And who wouldn't want more land? But again, let's not forget, sounds great, but how far are you going to go? The advice that Franz Joseph was getting was split because his government was split. Both the Hungarians and the Austrians agreed, yeah, we got to do something, but whereas the Austrians wanted to wipe the Serbians off the face of the map, the Hungarians were kind of thinking more along the lines of like economic sanctions. So, while the emperor wanted to go balls to the walls like the Austrians wanted at the same time, he kind of said, yeah, it's just my brother. But the problem was, as he's sitting there trying to debate, trying to figure it out, time is going by. And the longer you wait to react, how does that look?
Like you're weak.
Has the President of the United States done anything to the fact that we lost yet another 3 American soldiers?
He's done nothing.
No, not at all. We're going to do something. We're going to do something. Like, remember when he promised he was going to go visit that small town in Ohio where the train derailed and all the chemicals spilled? He never went. But he'll get there someday.
He can even remember where the frigging door is.
I'm sure they have big stickers. Mr. President, go this way.
Actually, they got a handler just off camera. Come on, come on, come on, Joe.
Yeah.
I got an ice cream for you. All right. So, what are we gonna do? Well, the key thing to remember is even if Austria did something, it should have been between the Austrians and the Serbians. But we have that goddamn alliance system that we gotta deal with. You have interlocking attitudes, desires. You had treaties, you had agreements, you had understandings, some formal, some informal. If Russia wanted to look like they were truly friends of the Balkan people, they would have to do something. Because how many times have they screwed the Serbians over in our class? What do we have to, 4 or 5? I've lost count.
A lot.
A lot in little more than my lifetime. 50 years over and over and over again. So at some point they're going to have to do something. But if they do something, what about the French? Do the French get involved? And if the French get involved, do the Germans get involved? And then what about the British? The British have the least formal of all the agreements. Do they get involved? And then what about the Italians? What about the Japanese? And on and on and on. What happens if someone does something? Well, the Austrians didn't have an answer. So you know what they decided to do? They decided to reach out to the one nation they could count on. Germans. And the Germans, in true German fashion, urged toughness. The advice that the Austrian ministers received was that they should make an example out of the Serbians. That they should prove, the Austrians, their racial superiority to the inferior Untermensch, those subhuman Slavic peoples. Now, truth be told, the Kaiser's government really didn't care what the Austrians did, because the Germans were only concerned with their own interests. Where were the Austrians gonna get their munitions from?
Germans.
Oh, yeah! So the moment the Austrian guns start going boom, 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 they're going to need to get resupplied from somewhere. And the German factories are ready to go. This would be perfect. Because apparently, June 28th, 1914, June 29th, 1914, June 30th, there's nothing that has survived that showed that Germany had any inclination of actually getting involved in military operations. But, despite that, for some reason, Willy contacts Franz Joseph personally and promises, well, if Russia does anything to you, if Russia gets involved, we get you back. And he promised full support, which, of course, today modern historians refer to as the infamous blank check. To what extent? Well, according to the dispatch that was taken of the phone call, it said, and I quote, "Even if serious European complications arise." So, what does the Kaiser advise? He tells the Austrian emperor, overwhelm Serbia. Overwhelm them completely. Send a literal tsunami at them. Overrun their defenses. Overrun their country. completely. Knock Serbia out in a week. If you can overwhelm them, you will be able to do so before anyone does anything. Before even the next domino falls. And, as Chancellor Bentham Hollweg stated to his Austrian counterpart, "This type of war, and I quote, is the best and most radical solution to the your Baltic problem. Balkan problem." Because after all, if war is unavoidable, better to do it now than to wait. Then they were asked the tough question. Well, what if Russia moves against us? Well, Germany basically said, we'd start mobilizing. We'd start saber rattling. That we'd make the Russians back down. But you know something? The one thing the Germans seemed to overlook were the French. Because ultimately, if Germany was to mobilize against Russia, that's the reason why they have the dual alliance between the two. But Germany believed overwhelming strength, destroy Serbia, we'll mobilize, that will cause Russia to back down, and when Russia backs down, we'll back down before France even lifts a finger. It's the perfect plan. It will work perfectly because plans always work just as you expect. Unfortunately, a weird curveball got thrown because out of nowhere, at the very same time that Germany is telling Austria to do it, in the last few days of June, first week of July, out of nowhere, it's announced that the French Prime Minister and the French President, or the French President's Raymond Poincaré, shows up in Russia and engages in a formal diplomatic visit. They parade around St. Petersburg. They see the Russian forces marching on parade. They visit some of the sites. At the very instant the Germans believed the French would never act, the freaking French president's there with the Tsar. Surely if Austria was to strike, Russia was to declare it was mobilized, and then Germany out of nowhere would say they were mobilizing, what do you think the first call the French president would make would be? He'd call back to his home country and say, guys, I'm in Russia, they're getting ready, let's go. This apparently suddenly caused the German high command to become nervous. Well, maybe the French will actually do something. They didn't like the idea of the Russians and the French leaders working together, particularly at the moment the crisis is breaking out. German war plans were based on the French slowly mobilizing in a slow response to a slow Russian mobilization. So out of nowhere, the Germans contact the Austrians and said, slow things down. I know we're now 3 or 4 days beyond the death of your heir to your throne, but just slow your roll down a bit. Slow down. To which the Austrians basically said, well, our only ally is telling us to slow down. Maybe we're going to have to slow things down. Questions? So how do you slow things down slower than they already were? Well, on July 7th, there's a joint council session of the Austrian and the Hungarian ministers. They gather in Vienna, and all present decide that war is a possible consequence of the assassination of our heir, and that we would be justified in responding, but we're not ready yet. Truth be told, and this is where the nature of the Austro-Hungarian army comes into play, most of their soldiers are farmers. And during the summertime, the army is always sent home for 3 weeks on what's called harvest leave. The boys leave the bases, go back to their families, and they help with the harvest. So their army is not actually ready to go because there is no army. They're on vacation. Under the calendar, they're not scheduled to return until July 15th. So even if they wanted to declare war on the 28th or the 29th or the 30th, they couldn't have done so because they didn't have an army to deal with. So you know what they decide to do? We're going to wait to do anything until the 23rd. A week after all the soldiers come back. So that way our war leaders can prepare the soldiers for the war. Well, they figure this is the perfect date because under the schedule, that's also when the French leaders are scheduled to depart from Russia. So they'll be out at sea. And the one thing they didn't have back then were these. So how are we going to do it? Are we just going to attack? Well, we can't do that under international law. Sneak attacks are not allowed. Plus, if we attack first, who's the aggressor? Who's the victim? And where do sympathies usually go? Yeah, to the victim. So we need to look like we're the victim here. So you know what they decide to do? They draft a 10-point ultimatum. We know what an ultimatum is, right?
Do this or face the consequences.
Mm-hmm. It's a set of demands. Guess how many demands they make? Guess how many demands they make?
10.
What gave it away?
Lucky guess.
Okay, very good. All right. So here's the thing. 6 p.m. Thursday on July 23rd, Austria sends via courier a 10-point ultimatum. It arrives in the Serbian capital in the foreign minister's office, who then presents it to the prime minister, who then presents it to the king. In the dispatch, Serbia is given 48 hours to reply. 48 hours to the 10-point demand. All right, you can Google these, so you don't necessarily need to write them down. First things first, the Serbian government must agree that it's going to suppress any anti-Austrian press, which we call censorship. So the government's going to shut down their newspapers from printing stories that are negative against the Austrians. Demand number two. The Serbian government must dissolve the Black Hand, that terrorist group which infests their military. Arrest its members and prevent future groups from forming. So you're going to go get them, even though they've been a pain in the ass of your government. You're going to find them all, you're going to arrest them, and then you're going to stop other groups from forming. Three, Serbia has to prevent anti-Austrian teachings in school. There's always been propaganda in school, always. But the Austrians don't want the Serbians having any anti-Austrian propaganda. They have to be taught to love their Austrian neighbors, which is propaganda. Four, any officer or soldier or government official who somehow accesses anti-Austrian propaganda has to be fired. So the government has to go into the homes of every single officer or soldier or government official, go through everything they have, and if they have a single scrap of anything that could be perceived as anti-Austrian, they have to be fired. Demand number five. Austrian officials must be allowed to come into Serbia to investigate the assassination. So that means the Austrians want full access to the Serbian government's records. Six. Serbia was to arrest and try all those involved in the assassination. Seven. They have to arrest one named officer, Major Voja Tenkosic, who the Austrians believe is the leader of the Black Hand. So we got to suppress anti-Austrian press. You got to get the Black Hand. You got to prevent anti-Austrian teachings. You have to fire any officer or official that has anti-Austrian propaganda. You have to allow the Austrians to come in and access all Serbian government records. You have to arrest and try those responsible for the assassination. You have to arrest the leader of the Black Hand. Oh, Serbia also has to stop any weapons legally being smuggled across the border. And as if all those weren't good enough, the ninth, hands down, is my favorite. The Serbian government must share with the Austrian government any anti-Austrian statements made by Serbian officials abroad. So if there's a Serbian living in New York City and he says something against the Austrians, and he's a government official, the Serbian government has to report him. I don't know how it would work, but that's what the Austrians want. All right, and number 10, Serbia has to tell Austria when 1 through 9 are complete. So, 48 hours to agree to all of those demands. What's the flaw? What's the one thing that usually comes with an ultimatum that I didn't mention?
Subjugation?
No. If I'm going to give you an ultimatum, what does that usually involve? Or if not just violence, maybe the threat of violence, you know, some type of consequence. If you don't do this, this will happen. What did I not mention?
The threat.
They make all these demands saying Serbia has to do this, Serbia has to do that, Serbia has to do that. But you know what they don't say? Or what?
So unspeakable,
we
don't speak of it.
I guess it's the secret double speak in the small inverted white 6-point text. I don't know. So apparently, The Serbians get this, and they read through it, and they're like, what are we supposed to do with this? But, apparently, they saw the fact that there was no consequences, and they initially, apparently, according to the records that survive, it seems that the Serbs were initially willing to just say, okay, sure, whatever. But on midday, July 25th, the Serbians get news. It seems that the mood in Russia was slowly swinging, finally, once again, in the pro-Serbian sense. It seems that the Tsar, while he had not declared mobilization, was on the verge, and this is through spy channels, to announce what technically could be labeled as a period preparatory to war. What the hell does that mean? Well, under international law, that's not an actual movement of troops, but it's a declaration that you intend to do so soon. So it's like a pre-mobilization mobilization. This, under international law, is usually the last opportunity to engage in diplomacy. So, the Serbs were willing to go along with it, but then they hear the Tsar is finally going to come to our aid, like we've been asking for oh so long. And then you know what they do? They changed what they were going to say. Just before the deadline, the Serbians reply, knowing Russian sentiment, in an emboldened way. And let me tell you, this is a masterclass in diplomatic responses. Bismarck could not have done better himself. I've already laid out broadly what all the 10 points were. Well, what do the Serbians say? Well, they agree to 3 of the points fully. 6, however, they have reservations. One of which they decide they're going to reject outright. And that's the 5th point. So, for instance, as to them looking to the anti-Austrian statements abroad. That was one of the things they responded with reservations. And they actually put in their reply, we're not exactly sure how would we do that. Could you explain it to us? You know, just brilliant. Brilliant. But to the 5th, that was the one they rejected. The investigation. Because you know why? In their response, they pointed out to the Austrians, if we allow your officials to come in and begin going house to house, investigating this incident, that would be a violation of our constitution. Because the Serbian constitution at the time granted full due process of law, which means you're innocent until you're proven guilty. So if you're going to go in and you're going to start taking records and making accusations, you're going to accuse people of guilt, even though they may not be proven guilty. And what nation on earth would knowingly violate their own constitution? Legally speaking, it can't be done. Oh my God. God, if they only had video footage. I would have loved to seen the facial expressions of the Austrians when they opened the response. Because what the Serbians managed to do is paint the Austrians completely into a corner. Because now what? A, there's no consequences to begin with. They agreed to most. They just didn't agree to everything. And even those things they disagreed with, they're like, well, here's our kind of reasoning behind. And the only one they disagreed with would be a violation of their constitution. Wow. Master stroke. Simultaneously to transmitting the response, the Serbians also sent another message. Serbian Prime Minister Nikola Pašić would order the army to mobilize. The active troops are mustered. The reserves are put on notice that all soldiers have to be prepared for repositioning at predetermined points at predetermined points of time. This too is also transmitted to Vienna. So now what? Now what? Well, you know something? Nothing for 2 days. 48 hours went by after the Austrians receive Serbia's reply to the ultimatum and notification that they're mobilizing their army. And they didn't do a damn thing. Now, apparently, what was going on behind the scenes was that diplomats began working overtime. The German ambassador to Britain and France warned them that they should contact the Russians to basically get the Russians to stand down, implying that if the Russians decide to mobilize in response to whatever Austria does, this would be the destruction of the Russian Empire. The German ambassador to Russia warned that Germany's first response to Russian mobilization will be German mobilization. Now, while this is going on, the French and the Brits actually did try contacting the Russians and tells the Tsar's government to go slow. Go slow. It appeared, even at that last hour, the Russians were willing to accept a mediation, but only if the English, the French, the Germans, and the Italians would gather together and meet with the Austrians, Serbians, and the Russians. Based on what has survived, it seems like most of the diplomats believed, oh, this is another 1909 again. This is another 1913. We've been here before. We'll have a conference. We'll engage in diplomacy. And everything will be fine. The one thing they didn't expect was out of nowhere, Austria's reply. Early morning, July 28th. To the shock of the world, Austria doesn't declare it's mobilizing. No, 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 no. It declares war on Serbia. Now, under the Hague Peace Conference, declarations must be formally delivered to an ambassador or other government official. So, an Austrian official was telegraphed the declaration of war, and he personally delivered it to the Serbian Prime Minister. The moment it is received, the state of war is legitimate. Meaning, rounds can now be exchanged, and it's not a violation of international law. FYI, within a few hours, Austrian guns on the Danube River opened up, and Belgrade received direct fire. And the Serbians responded in kind. Now what? Well, Russia was definitely in a difficult position. Its war plans were based only on a combined war with both Austria and Germany. Russia planned on only going to war because that would be the only circumstance that would bring the French in. So if they just partially mobilized, they would have to fight Austria alone, which would allow France to declare its neutrality. So the Tsar, on July 30th, reluctantly authorized a full mobilization to force the Germans to mobilize, which would force the French to get involved. Now here's the weird thing. With full mobilization by Russia, Germany now could play the victim. But to do so, Germany had to act fast. Because German war plans actually involved a two-front war with knocking France out first, quickly, and then circling all its strength to the Eastern Front and fighting the larger military army. But here's a weird thing. On the left is the Kaiser. And this was a fun holiday picture that they took. Because what the Kaiser is wearing is actually a Russian field officer's uniform. And standing on his right is Nicholas II. Similarly, wearing a German field general's uniform. They play dress up. Well, apparently, on July 30th, the Kaiser calls Nicholas, even though Nicholas is engaged in full mobilization. And he basically tells Nicholas, don't do this. The response is one of those things you hear in history that makes you go. The Tsar replied, I'm sorry, Willie, I have no other choice. So, when Russia ignores the warning to stand down, Germany similarly contemplated limited mobilization because they feared British entry. But when the high command informed him, if we only did it halfway, that would be chaos, the Kaiser reluctantly agreed to full mobilization. And this is where the dominoes begin to fall. Over the next 2 weeks, there would be a total of 44 declarations exchanged. Do not write these down. Just listen. August 1st, in response to Russian mobilization, Germany declares simultaneously it's engaged in full mobilization and it's declaring war on Russia. In response, France declares it's going to mobilize in response to German mobilization. Germany turns around and demands that France remains neutral, to which the French say, no, too bad. But to the shock of the Kaiser's government, Italy declares neutrality. Because in their response, they say, wait, I'm in a defensive treaty. But who's the one declaring war on who? So Italy backs away from its allies. Denmark, Sweden, Norway, they unite and issue a joint declaration of neutrality. But when Italy backs out, the first secret communications go from Berlin to Constantinople. And the Germans began secretly negotiating with the Ottomans to get them to come into the war. August 1st was a busy day. August 2nd, Germany announces it intends on using Belgium to strike at France from the north. Unlike in the Franco-Prussian War, where they went just through Alsace and Lorraine, Germany tells the war they're engaging in a sweeping maneuver. Well, the problem is in 1839, when Belgium was created, ripped out of the Netherlands, the empires of England, France, Prussia, Austria, and Russia all signed a pledge in the Treaty of London guaranteeing Belgian neutrality in all continental conflicts. England contacts Germany and says, hey, look, the Prussians back in 1839 agreed to recognize Belgian neutrality. We expect you to do the same. Well, Germany's response was a quick, sudden invasion of Luxembourg, which was another gateway to the French, because what they're doing is they're opening up all paths inward. August 3rd, Belgium formally rejects access to their country by the Germans. So Germany declares war on France. France declares war on Germany. Switzerland declares neutrality. August 4th, the first German troops march into Belgium. When that occurs, Great Britain declares war on Germany. The United States, however, and says, hey, this has nothing to do with us. The United States declares neutrality. August 5th, that power country in the Balkans, Montenegro, declares war on Austria-Hungary. The Ottomans shut down the Dardanelles to all traffic. August 6th, Austria declares war on Russia. Serbia declares war on Germany. August 7th, Spain declares neutrality. August 8th, Montenegro declares war on Germany. August 11th, France declares war on Austria. August 12th, Britain declares war on Austria. August 23rd, Japan declares war on Germany. August 25th, Japan declares war on Austria. August 28th, Austria declares war on Belgium. And on November 1st, the Ottoman Empire officially declares war on Russia, joining what would become known as the Central Powers. In response, Russia declared war on the Ottomans. November 5th, France declares war on the Ottoman Empire. November 11th, Ottoman Empire declares war on Japan and Britain. December 2nd, Serbia declares war on the Ottomans. December 3rd, Montenegro declares war on the Ottomans. December 5th, England declares war on the Ottomans, as do the Japanese. It wouldn't be until May 1915 when another nation would enter the fray. nation after nation after nation, declare war, declare war, declare war, declare war, neutrality, declare war, 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 boom. On August 3rd, 1914, while all this is going on, British Foreign Minister Sir Edward Grey issues a famous remark, which was quoted in the newspaper, in which he states, "The lamps are going out all over Europe. We shall never see them lit again in our lifetimes." Now, here's the greatest irony. Remember back in 1908 when the Austrians and the Russians had a deal where the Austrians would take Bosnia-Herzegovina and the Russians would get access to the Straits? Foreign Minister Sir Edward Grey was the one who personally called the Germans to block the Russian access to the Straits. I love this quote, because this was the sentiment of the times. Oh my God, oh, we're all going to die. But the destruction was a result of decisions made by the very men who now sit back and lament what's to come. It's a good lesson on politics. Because who is the first ones to step forward and cry when something goes wrong? Usually the very politicians that cause it to begin with. Questions? Now let's go to war. Woohoo! Enough with diplomacy stuff. Let's go to war. Awesome. Alright, see, the older you get, the more history you study, the more you realize that historians in particular tend to make as many mistakes as other people. Because writing history is hard. And oftentimes a historian has an agenda and wants to use that agenda to get a little bit of fame, to help sell books, which will help put money in their bank account. So rather than digging down, trying to actually find the truth, they will use generalizations to get people all fired up using emotion. One of the common things that I see when I read modern history books, when they talk about World War I, is the misconception that Europeans plunged into death like lemmings. They believed that everybody willingly went over the abyss together. But the problem with that is it actually ignores what had been going on in the two decades before World War I erupted. The truth of the matter is, there was a huge amount of change that had been taking place. For example, there was huge progress towards, I don't want to call them free markets, but there was a lot of international communication, cooperation that was going on. Some of the first international banks were opening up. There were firms engaged in international transportation. It was possible to get on a boat for the first time and really go anywhere on Earth if you had the money for it. Telephone and telegraph lines were linking even the most remote places on Earth, allowing you almost to the point where you could pick up a phone on one end, call into the operator, and eventually through a bunch of connections get you to the point where you could talk to someone on the other side of the earth. Unthinkable just a decade before. Plus, we didn't cover them because they're kind of boring, but there were also significant international conferences going on besides the one we talked about. For instance, there were two gatherings at The Hague, one in 1901, one in 1907, where they're working out all of the international law stuff that I was referencing towards. They're trying to formalize, make rules behind diplomacy in hopes of avoiding conflict. Plus, in almost every single major nation, there were growing pacifist groups, anti-war groups, that were using their numbers to convince politicians not to go to war in the first choice. But rather, they were popularizing conversations, words, diplomacy. And, probably most importantly, beginning in 1912, England and Germany had actually opened up dialogues. So even though you had the two-armed camp, it seemed like England was willing to kind of bring Germany almost into its sphere. And if they had actually formalized the treaty, oh my God, I don't know how I could draw that one out. The Triple Entente, the Triple Alliance, and then in the middle of it, you got Germany and England who are friends. But they were working on it. The truth of the matter is that historians should paint prior to June 28th as a period of peace. Everything was going in that direction. And but for the Austrians pulling out the declaration of war out of nowhere, it's possible that this could have been negotiated. And that's where everyone believed they were going. But we also have to recognize, the moment the war came, it was celebrated by many, if not most, of the people. Sigmund Freud commented, "All of my libido goes to Austria-Hungary, his homeland." Even Sigmund Freud, the greatest psychologist ever to live, wanted the Austrians to punish the Serbians. Thomas Mann, this guy, chowing down on a cigar right there. Right there, Thomas Mann, novelist. He wrote a story in the newspaper that he was, and I quote, "tired, sick, and tired of peace." And that he was, and I quote, "eager for purification, of which only a war could provide." Thomas Mann believed that the youth of the day had become soft and lazy. So what better way to toughen them up? Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler is there. That's a blow up. That's Adolf Hitler. He's in a crowd in Munich at the Odenplatz when word of the declaration is publicly read. And as he later said in his book, Mein Kampf, I quote, "In the moment, I was overpowered by stormy enthusiasm. I fell down on my knees and I thanked heaven from an overflowing heart for granting me the good fortune of being permitted to live at this time." Teddy Roosevelt was quoted as saying, "If Lincoln had lived in a time of peace, no one would have known his name." But most significant was the poet H.A. Vachel, who had wrote a poem in the journal The Hill, talking about noble deaths. And I quote, "To die young, clean, ardent, to die swiftly in perfect health, to die saving others from death, or worse, disgrace, to die scaling heights, to die and to carry with you into the fuller, ampler life beyond, unattained hopes and aspirations, unembittered memories, all the freshness and gladness of May. Is that not cause for joy rather than sorrow? But were they ready for it? Well, truth be told, the nations were preparing for it. You know the old adage, you prepare for war in hopes you never have to go. Since the Franco-Prussian War, which we talked about, and hopefully I've gotten this into your head, when Germany was created, everything changed. There was a huge imbalance. Germany became the dominant nation on the continent, economically, socially, intellectually, scientifically, but most importantly, militarily. The reason being was their fighting force. Unlike most of the other nations in Europe at the time, the Prussians gave to Germany a highly organized professional army. The army itself had one of the most effective, well-trained, competent officer corps on the entire earth. Their general staff literally was the brain of the operation. It formulated all strategies, and it embraced all technological innovations. There was no advantage that the general staff was not prepared to embrace fully. Again, when I briefly talked about the Franco-Prussian War, the Prussians had actually sent officers and observed Civil War battles, both sides. And they took notes. Look at what the Union's doing. Look at what they're doing well. Look at what the Confederacy is doing. Look at what they're doing well. Look at what both sides are doing wrong. Let's repeat. Good. Let's ignore bad. So in building their army, they literally used the lessons of the U.S. Civil War along with the Holzwig-Szwezlik War and the six-week war with Austria and the Franco-Prussian War. All of the lessons they learned, they applied. And they created a huge army. 1914, they had just in their active duty forces over 800,000 strong. Plus, they had 4 million reservists. And could draw from one of the largest European populations on the continent. It's 65 million people living in Germany. Their soldiers were the best trained on any force on earth. The reason being length of service. All males at the age of 17 could be called on to serve. They had a draft. But when you were drafted, they put you through physical observation and testing. And the Germans willingly rejected the physically and mentally unfit. 6% of the males didn't qualify to serve in the army. They didn't want them. Now, during peacetime, at 17, you began your physical training. Your service began at 20. So you had, once you were called on, you had 3 years to get yourself ready to go. At 20, you would report, and you would either spend 3 years in, if you got sent to a cavalry or an artillery unit, or all other units, including the infantry, 2 years of service. But the military determined where you were going to go, not you. Once you finished your active duty, you then spent 4 or 5 years in the regular reserves. So if you were a cavalryman, you only had 4 years of reserves because you had 3 years of active duty. If you're in the infantry, you had your 2 years of active, but you had 5 years of reserves. Then at that point, for the next 12 years, or until the age of 39, whichever came first, you were part of what was called the Landwehr, which was a government-organized militia, in which you would be expected once a month to muster with the other militiamen in your community, and a German officer would come to your village and kept you through your paces. This meant that they could tap on the entire male population, 17 all the way up to 39. Oh, and by the way, just because you hit 39 didn't mean you were done. At that point, you became part of the auxiliary militia, the Landsturm, in which all men were required to remain active in until 45. So instead of giving military drills, you learn how to do things like mechanics, you know, weapons repair, things like that. But you're still training, preparing to go. And they had the latest weaponry. The German soldier went into the battlefield armed with the standard issue Gewehr 98. Bolt action. 5-round internal magazine. Firing 8mm German bullets. I should have brought one. Because I got a Mauser, but it shoots the same thing. But I don't want anyone to say, oh my god, the Manic's got bullets. But let's just say with the cartridge, it's about this big. This rifle had a maximum of fire range of 2.4 miles. A good, well-trained soldier, because you would load the magazine with a stripper clip. So you'd get this little brass thing and you could slot 5 bullets in. So you discharge your bolt action, you fire your 5 rounds, you pop it open, you put the stripper in, you pop your next 5 in. Well-trained German soldier could get off 15 rounds per minute. It was a simple, strong, safe rifle that had been tested in development in civilian purposes. It started off as a hunting rifle. But if you can bring down a buck, you can bring down a human being. In terms of sidearms, the German soldiers, depending upon what units they were in, had one of two issued to you. The most common was the Mauser C96 semi-automatic pistol. Like I said, 9mm, fired its cartridges also out of a box. Semi-automatic, pull the trigger, it reloads itself. Actually, boom, 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 boom. Usually, the more elite units, they were issued the more expensive, more complicated Luger. This is a picture of, I think it's the Luger P08. I think that's the Mauser version of it, too, also. Also fires 9mm rounds. 8-round magazine, which can be fed through the bottom handle. The biggest problem, of course, is the action. When it fires and it cycles out the bullet, this section up here comes up and forms like a little triangle. So if you have your gun, your finger on top, you could get it seriously sliced. And as a result also of the design, dirt could get into it easily. But again, it was still an effective side piece. Very useful, very useful. The Germans also utilized two widely used, very effective artillery pieces. Right here, this little picture right here is heart-finding pictures. This is the 7.7 cm flat trajectory artillery gun. It fires a 77 millimeter shell, 15 pound impact. The most common round discharged out of it was high explosive. And it had percussion cap on it. So when it impacted, the tip of the bullet hit the ground, and that's what detonated, allowing shrapnel to be disseminated, basically wreaking havoc wherever it landed. Eventually, they would put timers, and they would figure out how to detonate the shells over the enemy positions. So the round would be fired, and it would explode overhead, and shrapnel would rain down out of the sky. But more lethal, particularly once trenches developed, was this thing right here. This is a trench mortar. This fires a 25 millimeter mortar projection shell right here. Each shell weighs roughly 200 pounds. And it's high explosive. So it goes up, it's a mortar, so it has a higher trajectory, and it comes down, and when it lands, it has a tendency to blow holes downward. So it makes huge impact craters. The C-77 flat trajectory gun, that has a range of about 5 miles, whereas the mortar fires mortar rounds about a half mile. Now here's the thing. When Germany went to war, they had 5,100 of the C-77s ready to go, and they had about 45 of the mortars ready to go, but by the end of the war, they had over 1,200 in service. But here's really where their big advantage was, as if these guns were not already superstars in themselves. Right here, the Germans was the first army to adopt a machine gun. This is the Maxim MG08 water-cooled, belt-fed, fully automatic machine gun. You take a belt of 8 millimeter rounds, usually 600 to 800 rounds long, and you put one end in and you pull the trigger. The belt comes in and bullets get fired. Capable of firing about 400 rounds per minute. Human beings would be incapable of surviving the Maxim discharge. It's not just jing, jing. It's wall of lead. And it's water cooled, not air cooled. So literally they had a water can. That's what this hose is. There's a water can over here. Because they fire at such great rates that the barrels become red hot and heated. So the only way to keep things cool is to apply moisture to it. Heavy gun, 140 pounds. It took a crew of 4 men to set up and operate. 1914, Germany had 1,000 Maxims ready to go. Another advantage that they had, that they learned from the U.S. Civil War, truth be told, The only reason why the Union won is because the Union had more miles of railroads. And they were able to logistically redeploy armies, supplies, and materiel. One of the first things that Bismarck did when he became the chancellor for Prussia was he turned over to the Prussian army full monopolistic control over the railroads. The railroads were owned by the army. They were operated by the army. All of the railroad lines were laid by the army, all for military purposes. And when Germany was unified, Bismarck allowed the army to continue to control the railroads. So yeah, there were mail train cars that went by. There were supply cars that were attached. But the priority on every single railroad was always military purposes. So when the war came, the German soldiers didn't march to war. They were brought up to the front. Which meant instead of marching hundreds of miles, you sat in a train. And then the moment you were deployed, if you got injured, you could be put on a train and brought back. Or if you started running low on food, a train could come up and bring food. Bullets could be brought up by the train load, no pun intended. Another difference between the German military machine and everybody else, this. Their officers were careerists. And their NCOs, non-commissioned officers, were given promotions based on merit. To be an officer, even an NCO, you had to attend officer school. So you were trained for the job. And going to an officer school had you bombarded with tactical knowledge that you had to prove you understood in order to lead men on the battlefield. And, well, go back, we're not doing the French. And even to qualify, it had to be earned. It's the last example that I'm going to call it a day. The highest medal given out to German soldiers is the Iron Cross. Adolf Hitler received 2 during his years of service, which is, we're going to find out, was actually throughout the entire war, all 4 years. But despite that he had those 2 and numerous other medals, he had what our military would consider to be a very impressive rack. He was never promoted above a corporal. The reason being, he did brave things on the battlefield, but his officers saw no leadership potential in Adolf Hitler. Which is kind of ironic when you think about it. All right, questions? All right, I went slow today because this is very just the good stuff. We're going to come back. We're going to take a look at all of the militaries. We're going to finish going through all of the major armies. And, yeah, we're going to get into it. That is for sure. Questions? All right, cool. If you haven't gotten the books yet, you might want to do so.